If this interests you, please go to kboo.fm/stationmanagerhire2013.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Up next is Art Focus with host Joseph Galaban. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, open daily December 18th through December 24th for the Festival of the Last Minute. Saturday Market offers handmade art, crafts, and other gifts created by artists from the Pacific Northwest and is located at Southwest Ankeny and NATO Parkway in Waterfront Park. Information at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen.
I'm Joseph Galavan, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week, our guest is Ben Buswell, a conceptual artist whose show We Live Only Through Ourselves is on now at Up4 Gallery until January 25th, 2014. Welcome, Ben. It's lovely to have you here at KBOO.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Joseph.
So you make large photographs, and then you cut the surface thousands of times to change the image. Are you a photographer?
I'm decidedly not a photographer. I actually try to keep myself pretty naive when it comes to photography. I want the camera to kind of give me what it will give me and leave that a little bit to chance.
Mm-hmm. So in the Up4 gallery, as you go in, there is there are four big photos framed low to the ground, and they are images of the Columbia River, sort of ripples and small waves on the surface. There's like two surfaces. The dark face of the water is facing you, and the light face is a reflection of the sky, so it's kind of facing the sky. And you've basically taken a knife or something and cut thousands and thousands of little lines in the two surfaces, in the black and in the light.
Right.
And just tell me, how did you do that and why did you do that?
The how is I used a etching stylus. So it's a little steel tool that you normally use for scratching through hard ground on a copper plate. And then I just put a tiny little bit of an edge on it with a sharpening stone. And I would essentially use it like you would making a intaglio print.
Mm-hmm.
Or a drawing, and scrape it like a pencil.
Yeah.
And what it does is it's meant to be a little bit of an aggressive mark, but a subtle aggressive mark cutting into the surface of the photograph. My real goal is to get between the emulsion and the image and the paper in this subtle kind of nod towards relieving the image into space, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pulling that image away from being its flat, kind of still captured self and making it living, breathing kind of thing again.
And these prints, you went out to the river with an assistant and you put two cameras in the ground and shot two images. Just tell me why you did that.
So I work a lot with mirrored images. And for this large quad, having four total images, we needed two side-by-side shots to create the four wide mirroring effect. And so my assistant and I went out to the Columbia and she'd wade out and put a pole in the river, and we'd line up the left-hand side of one camera with the right-hand side of the other camera, you know, in the shot, pull the stake out of the river, and then count down 3, 2, 1, click. And we would just kind of spray and pray that way all day and take, you know, hundreds and hundreds of shots that I could later cull through and kind of find the images to use.
And you were just shooting the water surface. There was no landscape effect, no trees in the background.
Right. No, it's not. I mean, I'm really drawn to the Columbia because, you know, as a native West Coaster, I'm kind of fascinated by the idea that this, you know, Lewis and Clark and all these kind of things, this is where essentially the march of Western history ended. It ended in a more Spanish kind of way down in California and, you know, French way in Canada and all these things. But essentially, this is where the kind of map ended. And the Columbia plays a big part in that. But I think really that's kind of my personal interest in a subtext. For me, the water, sand, these other types, skin, these types of surfaces that I take pictures of really have more to do with, they're surfaces that we read as mass, right? We read the surface of the water and we know that it's deep and full, and we know that the skin is a covering for the mass of the body. So they're surfaces that live between kind of image and object. Mm-hmm. And that's a place I like to put my work, is between that idea of image and object.
Mm-hmm. So you were shooting really an abstract image. It's just ripples.
Yeah.
And you print it up as a lambda print, also known as a C print in the galleries world. Right. So what is that? It's a big print.
So lambda prints are your standard way, you know, nowadays of making digital files into standard photographic prints. So it essentially uses the same, it's a Fuji Crystal Archive paper. It's the same type of paper that if you were a traditional photographer, you could expose with a negative. Only in industry now, you know, at Costco or Walgreens or any of these places, you can send a digital file, or Photocraft, where I had these printed, a more industrial printer. They use that paper and expose it with a laser on a drum instead of a large flat negative.
Mm-hmm.
But it gives you the same kind of textural quality. There's that thin layer of clear emulsion over the image, which is kind of caught in the emulsion,
mm-hmm.
Which I really like. And I think kind of reveals itself through the scratching, has a better body and more of kind of a fleshiness than an inkjet print does, which sits completely on top of the paper. It's a livelier, kind of juicier surface to work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're talking about little scratches that are maybe an inch long or even an eighth of an inch.
Right.
And do you work with a big magnifying glass?
No.
No,
no, so, I work just right down on the photo with my normal glasses.
Yeah. And you're cutting away the surface, and sometimes it kind of flicks up. There'll be like a little triangle, a sort of raggedy piece.
Right.
And you don't, that doesn't bother you, right? You just keep going.
No, I mean, I think that's part of being an artist that uses process, is that you make your decisions beforehand. And you follow those steps, and you follow the steps as true as you can without kind of inserting yourself into it,
mm-hmm.
Until it's done. And, you know, some people have come into the gallery and there were conversations about how meticulous the surfaces were. And for me, I understand where they're coming from. For me, those surfaces aren't meticulous because that sounds careful to me. And I think seeing those little flicks and scratches and, you know, the line will cut into another line, those type of, you know, quote unquote mistakes, again, brings a kind of life to it. If you had the time, you could see how my hand worked through the whole thing. There's kind of, you know, a real sense of the making in it.
Mm-hmm.
They're really quick and aggressive little marks, but there's just so many of them. It folds into this kind of more cohesive, quiet kind of surface and image.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so in terms of perspective, you frame these mirror images. It's like two images on the left and they're mirrored by the two on the right. The frames themselves are at different angles. They're like the bottom is closer to your feet than mm-hmm. the top. And there's sort of all sorts of planes going on. Why is there so much disruption in what you're doing to the photograph?
Yeah, I think that's like scratching the photos and trying to lift that paper to make the image more object-like. The framing is another way to do that. So if the photo itself has a perspective to it, the framing, by pushing the top back in space and letting the bottom come forward, it's a nod or a gesture towards recreating the perspective space of the image in reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, too, I think the other thing it does is by bringing the bottom of the frame out, it produces a frame with a lot more mass or volume than a normal frame on the wall does.
Yeah.
And so that they really hold a kind of physical space in the gallery, and the viewer has to deal with that with their body instead of kind of just by looking and you know, reading it symbolically like you would a kind of painting in a more standard
frame.
Yeah.
So these are like big boxes, and they kind of... You've got to get down on your knees to really appreciate the surface.
That would be great.
To get a good look.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Then there are two similar ones. I guess they're a diptych. It's two pieces facing each other, and they're waves, kind of sand waves. Mm-hmm. Not wet sand, but you were at the coast, right, and you saw something going on.
Right. So, yeah, we were at Manzanita one day, and the surface of the sand was being blown by the wind. It had been a hard wind all day, so it created this almost wave-like effect in the sand where you get these little ridges that would run in lines, and that's where those photos came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you do the same thing on one set of photos, you're poking through with a pin or something to get little pimples all over it.
Right. So, yes, on the one piece called First There Is a Mountain, it's a photo quad. There's four, and they're stacked like a totem against the wall, and they move out into space and then back away and then out again and then back away towards the wall. And two that move out are scratched like the waves are, you know, kind of dealing with that one-point perspective of the mm-hmm. sand in the photograph. And then the two that face down are poked with another type of etching tool, an etching needle, which is essentially like a sewing needle stuck in a stick of wood. Mm-hmm. And I would just go along on the face of the photo and push up slightly with it to kind of bring just a little dot of the surface back mm-hmm. out.
Yeah. And then opposite it, what's the one opposite called?
The opposite one is a stacked diptych, and the photos are a little bit larger. They're 24 by 36 instead of 20 by 30. And it's called, the first one is First There Is a Mountain, and that diptych is Then There Is No Mountain. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially the first two stanzas of a Buddhist saying, first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. And so these two working together kind of follow that line from losing the kind of symbolic self to becoming more present. So in the quad piece, you know, the surfaces are very slight and the perspective is based on the image. In the second piece, the images are larger and the frames protrude further into physical space, and the actual cutting and lifting of the photograph is more aggressive, more body-like, and the perspective of those lines is based on the edge of the photograph or the frame. So it's based on the physical part of the photograph rather than the image part of the photograph.
Yeah. So you did cuts from the bottom of the middle up in like a V shape all the way to the edge.
Right.
So it looks like a chevron, thousands of lines.
Right. Yeah. Those cuts were made by using the same type of scratch, only extending it out and then coming back with the same tool and physically lifting about 90% of that little ridge of photo out. So they really sit out and kind of, you know, wave almost the mm-hmm. way the tool would stretch mm-hmm. the emulsion as it came off.
Yeah. Yeah. You do the, well, you teach at PCC, and so your studio time is often late at night.
Yeah.
And you're doing this work, and you know, how long would it take to do like one of these images?
Each one is a little different. Each technique is a little different. The poking tends to take longer than the scratching, and then obviously the kind of long line ruler based cutting and then lifting is a two stage process. But you know, I'll listen to an hour of music or an hour of radio or something like that, and I'll look down and I'll maybe have finished a volleyball cereal bowl size chunk.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they could take a week
or more. I mean, a lot of people ask about the time, and I don't track it because it's time that I hope that I would spend in the studio anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And doing this type of work, it feels right for me. I feel like it puts me in time when I'm in the studio.
Yeah. Yeah. So what kind of stuff do you listen to while you're working?
I listen mostly to podcasts, 99% Invisible, you know, Love and Radio, Too Much Information.
What are they? What are they about?
99% Invisible is about the built environment, design and architecture and things like this. Too Much Information is a really crazy podcast that's mostly about the internet, but a lot about just the glut of information society. And Love and Radio is kind of all over the place too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just really lo-fi kind of things like that. And I feel like the podcasts, again, kind of keep me in time when you're working on something for a week or a month. Music will sometimes, you know, make me happy, make me sad. And if I'm trying to follow the same technique day after day, week after week, I need to keep in the same space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you brought in a track to listen to. It's called, it's by the Jesus and Mary Chain. It's called Just Like Honey, and it's the opening track of Psycho Candy. That was Just Like Honey by the Jesus and Mary Chain from Psycho Candy. And that album, how old is that album?
I think it's 28 years old, 1985.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a, yeah, it's old. I like the Wayback Machine when I listen to a lot of music.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What do you like about that particular track?
I tend to listen to music, Clinic, The Sons, Black Angels, you know, Jesus and Mary Chain, music that has really an open sound to it. I'm really drawn to that. And also, the thing I like about this band is that if you kind of take out the heavy distortion, all these, it's almost just like a straight up 1950s song, right? So it's old and new together. Ravenettes are really good at that too.
Oh, wow.
And I tend to listen to music when I'm in the building phases of things, right? So when I'm in the process side, I tend to listen to the podcasts, and when I'm in the kind of building, finishing, like, so there's really two soundtracks to my studio life.
Mm-hmm. Building, meaning you build the frames yourself?
But yeah, building the frames, painting the frames, the big tent piece, mm-hmm, in the show when I was kind of stitching that, the drawings into the tent, like that's music time, right? That's, mm-hmm, that's work time. And then the process time is kind of the podcast time.
Right. I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week, our guest is Ben Buswell, a conceptual artist whose show We Live Only Through Ourselves is on now at the Up 4 Gallery in the Pearl until January the 25th. Tell us about this tent, because most of the works in the room are on the wall, but then there's this white triangular tent that you can like lie down and crawl in, and there's a light in there. What is it called?
The title is When the Cathedrals Were White.
And that's from a book?
Yeah, it's actually from a book that was written by Le Corbusier, the architect. And he wrote that book after visiting the States and kind of seeing New York and its you know, haphazard, crazy, diverse architecture. And it's, the book is kind of a utopian modernist manifesto about how New York should be ripped down and essentially turned into this, you know, perfect grid of high functioning buildings. And when I, you know, I love the modernist architecture, but reading that book kind of scared me because the language in it was pretty aggressive as far as, you know, people who couldn't afford to, or minorities, or all of these other types of people that didn't fit his model would be left behind to history. And so I think the tent for me is a way to, like an architect, create a space for a person, mm-hmm, but instead of a kind of utopian vision that you lay on to somebody else, it's a place to have your own. Right. I think if I have my utopian dreams or all of these kind of plans that we make and ways we think, the most we can do is have it for ourselves, mm-hmm, and hope that other people can come along rather than it's essentially a Corbusier on the opposite. Right.
Right. And you use this stuff, Yupo paper, which I didn't know about. It's a kind of plastic paper for watercolor artists.
Right.
And it holds, well, you don't use watercolor, but apparently it holds color in a different way.
Right. I'm not sure of the exact history of it, but it's a polypropylene product. So it's a plastic paper, and they developed a tooth in the extrusion that holds the kind of, you know, the pigments in the watercolor really well. And Yupo is just a brand. There, mm-hmm, are other versions of it. But I was really drawn to it because it takes graphite really lusciously. It holds graphite really well. And then also I could cut the photographs and hit those little tiny slits with a heat gun, and the heat gun would essentially bloom open all of those little cuts. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of opening the paper up and making it more skin or hide or kind of fleshy body-like in that way. Mm-hmm. And the heat also made it a little rigid, so you could adapt it to structures too.
Right. So it looks like a little triangular tent, you know, like a cartoon drawing of a tent. And it's full of little slits that have opened up, so right. They're sort of oval shaped or whatever, wider in the middle slits. And so you drew on the paper, did you project a photo of water onto it?
Right. So it's a similar image of water that's in the yeah. large photo quad, only that particular one is from Devil's Lake, which is in Lincoln City, and it's a natural lake, but it's been very much controlled by man since mm-hmm. essentially the whole town around it is a kind of resort. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I would project it with an opaque projector and then draw with the graphite in the same way that I would scratch if it were a photo. Mm-hmm. And then again, like cutting those slits into the faces of the wave, into the part of the wave that has the most potential, right? The most kind of kinetic energy. That's where the energy of the wave is starting to come out, opening that up. And then those openings allow the light that's inside to project through and create an image on the wall. So
right.
It moves from the person's inside and they're in this kind of private space. They see the plan, right? The plan being the drawing.
The drawing, yeah.
And then the structure itself is creating the projection. So there's a little nod again to the kind of that, you know, how does the plan project, you know, against that idea, is the ideas that Corbusier had and the kind of, again, you know, aggression of those.
Mm-hmm. You mean like Corbusier's plan for New York, how would it play out in reality?
It's not how his plan would play out in reality so much as just making a private version of that. I mean, I think dreams are great. Utopia is great. Trying to get along is great, but he was willing to leave people behind. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I think, you know, we live only through ourselves. The individual, right, coming to terms with yourself, kind of having these private spaces and valuing that, not at the expense of others, is kind of the point, right? Creating, mm-hmm. having those plans and projections and ideas and structures in a private setting, mm-hmm. an individual setting, rather than top-down kind of management of it.
Yeah. There is a piece of ceramic work in there as well.
Right.
Well, that seems to be totally different from everything else.
It is different. I think a lot of this work, I had read Mark Doty's Heaven Coast, and my grandfather had just died. And so a lot of this work and, you know, kind of dealing with private space, dealing with private space, how do you deal with the loss of someone else, or how do you deal with other people through yourself? And that urn, it's again a kind of subtext to the work, like Corbusier is. The urn is me kind of dealing with my grandfather's death. Inside was in the high fire, so when the glaze was fired, you know, 2300 degrees or whatever, there was a little handmade object mm-hmm. that he had made that got emoliated or sacrificed in that fire. And suffice to say, it was, like Corbusier, something that was against my own personal politic. Right, so it's very similar to the tent, mm-hmm. just in a completely different type of way.
What was it?
It was a small hand-carved dancing African-American figure. Don't know if I can say those words on the radio.
Little minstrel.
It's minstrel, yeah. Yes, minstrel. It's now been turned to ashes in that urn that is sealed with its own glaze.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It, also in the back of the room, there are like photos that aren't part of the show, but right. they're, you know, they're like the gallery will sell them to people for right. a few grand. Right. And they're kind of more radical versions where you've cut the surface right off and it's sort of hanging in ribbons.
Right.
Lots of horizontal lines that peel down, hanging from the side of the picture like hair. Were they just experiments, or why are they not in the gallery?
I have always liked it when artists, especially object makers, treat the installation of a show as kind of a singular event. And I didn't want to you know, fill up the gallery with just all the work that was available. I wanted each piece to hold its space and kind of speak across the gallery to itself. I think those pieces are like the two sand pieces. They're a continuation of that exploration of how to make the photograph more physical. And they're also starting to kind of, you know, for me as a subtext, start to deal with this idea of memory, right? Constructed memory. And I think that's another thing that underlies all this. Neuroscience is kind of proving out that when you remember, you're actually making a new construction. So in a sense, memory is forgetting, right? The more you use a memory, the more it disappears. And I think that those are starting to lead me into a territory about that type of thinking, right? Mm-hmm. And the image, the photograph is a perfect thing to explore for that because it's the thing that we trust now. Mm-hmm. It's the thing that we trust to hold our past, as a direct kind of metaphor of that.
Yeah. What other media do you use or have you used extensively in the past?
I jump all medias. I'm a real materials person. Materials are the meaning in a lot of ways. I think, you know, for me, the material has as much to do with the meaning or how I feel or intuit a piece as the image does. So, you know, in the past, I have cast paint, like made sculptures out of thin sheets of cast paint. Mm-hmm. I used to work a lot with bender board, which is a flexible kind of plywood and made pieces that kind of referenced architecture. So you're using a floppy material to make, you know, forms that were at one time made out of stone, right? So again, kind of reversing the reality of the things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was that artist you talked about who in New York you liked the way he presented?
Oh, Robert Gober.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my young art life, I saw him, his show at the Venice Biennale. Actually, it was the first time I'd ever seen his work. And it had really struck me how the few objects he had kind of discreetly placed in the room and you know, engaging the floor, engaging the center of the gallery, how it wasn't necessarily a site-specific installation that dealt with the architecture, but kind of made the pieces bigger than the sum of each individual piece. I was really drawn to that.
Mm-hmm. And the meaning of your work, it's obscure. You know, you wouldn't get any of this by just looking around the gallery.
Right.
How do you think people can get the meaning? Or does it even matter that they come up with the same meaning you give it?
You know, I think in the end I'm a searcher. Like, I think all of my work, more or less successfully throughout the years, has all revolved around a central core that I can't hold on to, right? And so for me, all of the specific way that I think about perspective in a picture, all these things isn't so important that the viewer gets that, but rather that the pieces I make engage the viewer physically and mentally and essentially exist there as surrogates for me. I want them to have a presence in a very Robert Irwinian kind of way, but also enough of an image or a symbolic reading that the viewer is engaged mentally and physically. And you know, each one is kind of a stop along the way.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week, our guest is Ben Buswell, conceptual artist whose show We Live Only Through Ourselves is on our Upfall Gallery through January 25th. Thanks for coming in and talking to KBOO.
Oh yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Andy Warhol lifts a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol lifts a scream, hang him on my wall. Silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 19th year of the Portland Revels. The Portland Revels will perform 11 shows between December 6th and December 15th. That's the Portland Revels, December 6th to the 15th at the Scottish Rite Center in downtown Portland. More information about the show can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to news headlines for Tuesday, December 10th on KBOO News. The United States is airlifting African troops to the Central African Republic today as violence continues in that country. French troops were deployed to the CAR last week in an effort to stabilize the area. Two French soldiers were killed overnight by gunmen in the capital city. Crowds attacked a mosque, looted businesses, and burned cars. All of this took place just hours before French President François Hollande was scheduled to arrive for a visit. The violence has been ongoing since Muslim rebels seized power from President François Bozize in March. Sectarian violence between Muslims and Christians has left over 400 people dead. There will be a panel of speakers talking about how nuclear radiation is affecting the Pacific Northwest tonight at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. The panel will talk and answer questions about Fukushima, Hanford, and the Columbia Generating Station. In addition, there will be a Geiger counter demonstration. Those who have Geiger counters are encouraged to bring them. The event begins at 6:30 tonight. Edward Snowden's latest disclosures reveal that the United States has also been spying on video gamers around the world.